This episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by the Hair Club for Psychotic Men. You can look great and feel great as our talented barbers, who'd much rather be lumberjacks, make sure you look
exactly the same as when I first came in.
Right.
Because of our revolutionary services, we are able to keep our prices low, and we're slashing our fees. Slashing, razor, cut, cut, cut!
Cut, blood, spurred artery, murder!
Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hello, good day to you, Ben.
Good day to you, Nathan. And how is the 14th of December, 2019 treating you?
Oh, it's nice and crispy. I'm having a grand old day here out on the West Coast. How about yourself?
Well, you know, December comes but once a year, and it is an ominous sign that we are getting closer and closer to the shortest day of the year in northeastern New England, which means that, you know, the cold, grim realities of living in post-colonial America are going to hit us like a ton of bricks, or a 16-ton weight, if you prefer.
Not a metric ton, I'm assuming.
No, good old English measure. Python may have, over the course of its four seasons, converted from imperial currency to metric pounds and pence, but no, we are going to continue to measure those tons with an extra N-E at the end.
Today's episode is, of course, episode 9, The Ant, an introduction.
Yeah, a lot of ant content in this episode.
Yes.
No, wait.
There is actually an ant, a very big ant, in a different episode, which I was kind of surprised when I rewatched this, that is not this episode.
Mm.
The ants, if they're there, are so tiny, you don't really see them.
So we oftentimes begin, if there's any particular context or historical aspect of this episode that seems particularly important.
I'm a big proponent of bringing up first things that we see in Monty Python's Flying Circus. So I actually counted 2.5, I guess. The half being, this is the first identifiable Gumby character, played by Graham Chapman as the crooner.
Only make believe, I love you.
We did see a Gumby-like character with Cleese, where he had the napkin on the head and the dumb galoshes, but he was missing the sweater, he's missing the glasses and the mustache.
He was missing the name, whereas this Chapman's character is clearly identified with the surname Gumby.
Correct. So this is the first identifiable Gumby. We also see some recurring performers on Monty Python, the first wife of John Cleese, Connie Booth. She makes her first appearance. She's another American to perform on the show. And of course, she later went on with Cleese to make Fawlty Towers. Of course, there she had a much more formative, creative role to play. But here she's just basically the wife of the lady of the lumberjack.
Which I think is a little interesting in that I think I've gotten used to Carol Cleveland's vocal performance in the live episodes, is that I didn't even notice at first that it was Connie Booth during that sketch, because as we've mentioned in previous episodes, Cleveland has a marvelous dejected whine. She has a way of collapsing into tears and utter anguish that's really quite lovely and very funny. And so to have Connie Booth be the person who dissolves into dismay at Bevis's unmasculine behavior, I didn't even notice at first that it wasn't Cleveland doing her traditional comic trope.
I think at this point in the writing and performing, it's consumed their lives for the better part of a year. It's probably been a good 6 months plus even.
Yep.
And in interviews, Cleese has said that at that time where the long-term popularity of the show was still not in focus for them, he began to question, you know, I'm just newly married to this wonderful, lovely American lady. Do I want to spend all of my waking hours basically living, breathing, and bleeding this show? So it may have been that he was just trying to bring her into more of his life. And even if Connie, this is, I admit, as a speculation on my part, but based upon things that Cleese has himself has said in various interviews, mostly on the Fresh Air circuit, he just was getting a little bit lonely, I suppose. Like he was not seeing his wife as much. So this may have been just like an effort to bring her in. This is speculation on my part.
It's an interesting supposition. There's nothing on the face of it to contradict it. And it's a nice charitable thought that the set would have been open and welcome to being able to, you know, include somebody from your family, even in a bit part.
Who knows?
Is your third first that this is the first musical number in Monty Python's Flying Circus?
Well, it's technically not the first musical number because we do have the, if I were not in the CID, a window cleaner me, which is technically a musical number. But it's the first time you have a non, or I guess I should say, a deliberately good singing vocal performance from professionally trained singers.
And an original song.
Whereas
I am not familiar with the If I Was Not in the Blah Blah Blah, but it does have that quality of being a camp song or a playground rhyme where you have the fill in the blank of if I was not in this circumstance, I would rather do this profession, and the profession has some sort of fun, gamey rhyme slash gesture to go along with it. There are a lot of camp songs that end with you then have to do all of the different gestures from all of the different professions that had been named. So at the end, where John Cleese is barrister, he would have, in addition to doing the chuff, chuff, chuff of the engine driver, he also would have had to have done the window cleaner, a rub-a-dub-dub, and a rub-a-dub-dub. And then whoever went after him would have had to do all three in succession.
Mm-hmm. We're referring, of course, to the Fred Tomlinson Singers, who have been on the shortlist for professional singing groups of the BBC for at least a few other shows. On their IMDb page, they are credited with being on part of the Goodies, as well as the two Ronnies. I don't think they make more appearances beyond season one of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
No, they do. They are the Vikings in the Spam sketch. I don't know if that's season one or not, but they definitely appear at least twice in season four.
They do. Okay.
Yep. So, yeah, the first original song. I did not have the opportunity to sit down with a volume of Monty Python Sings to check the credits, but I did find a couple of online reviews that said most of the songwriting for Python was at least co-done by Eric Idle, and that they assumed, therefore, that this was probably his writing, at least for the lyrics and potentially for the music.
There's several interviews, I think on both sides, of both Terry Jones and Michael Palin, who wrote the sketch from which it kind of it forms the ending, and that is called The Homicidal Barber. They didn't really know how to end the sketch, and so Terry Jones just blurted out, let's finish it with a song. And so once they came up with that, the song sort of wrote itself. So I think the lyrics are actually Terry Jones.
Okay.
It is true that Eric Idle went on to go sing this part on the live shows. I think that's because Eric Idle is just a more comfortable singer than Michael Palin was. But the musical part may have been Eric Idle. That might be true. But I think the lyrics were from Terry Jones and Michael Palin.
Well, once this episode drops, you're free to check out our errata page on pythonperspective.com, where I will have done the research I should have done for this episode. And we'll have the songwriting credits for this song, if available, ready to plug in, because I'm not going to do an audio drop right here in order to correct myself. Hi, this is Ben from the future. Surprisingly, my usually reliable Monty Python library doesn't actually have a copy of Monty Python Sing, so I haven't had a chance to double check this yet, so I'm actually not dropping in a correction. Just dropping in to say, really do check the errata page. There'll be an entry on this eventually.
One other thing which I noticed, I tend to obsess over how does the intro or title credits differ, how do they differ? And for the first four, before the 2 week gap, there was a different way that John Cleese would say Monty Python's Flying Circus. Then after the 2 week gap, he changed it up to be a slightly more silly delivery.
Yes.
And so far that has remained consistent until this episode, where there's some sort of weird stereo out of sync, where you have almost an echo of Jonathan Cleese as he's saying
Monty Python's Flying Circus,
and it sort of echoes itself a little bit. And when I watched it, I wasn't quite sure if that was a mistake or if it was a deliberate thing that they did, but I'm guessing, because it appears later on in the episode where they have John Cleese actually in a split screen with himself saying, and now for something completely different. Also, they have a man with a tape recorder up his and his brother's nose. You get it in stereo. It may be a foreshadowing of a joke they're about to tell by having the Monty Python's Flying Circus be a slightly off-synced stereo delivery.
That is a really good connection. I like that a lot. I assumed it was just a random joke. And when you started talking about the fact that it might be mimed later in the episode, I was thinking about the stereoscopic vision of Sir George Head, OBE, the mountain climber who sees everybody in double.
Oh, yeah.
But I think you're much more correct in making the connection to the slightly off-sync in stereo performance of the Marseillaise up a man's nose and his brother's nose.
And now in stereo.
Interesting. It could be also the Sir George Head seeing double.
There are certainly a lot of doubles in the episode.
Hmm. Even as we're recording, we are peeling away layers and finding new stuff.
So I will also point out that in one of those odd things about filming in front of a live studio audience, we have sustained applause during the credits. Unlike ever before. So in addition to John Cleese's vocals being different than they normally are, we also have long extended clapping by the studio during Gilliam's animation, which is a completely different audience participation soundtrack to anything we've ever had before. So it really does start to feel like this show is coming into its own in terms of audience appreciation and recognition. There's a good chance that the people in the studio who were there to be there present for it knew what they were getting, that they recognized those credits, they were excited to be there, and they were participating in the live experience in a truly appreciative way.
Yeah, I think at this point, they're now 11 weeks into it since its first broadcast. That is definitely enough time for people to sit up and take notice and show up to the theater in a suit and tie and sit down and watch it. I wonder how much it cost to get in or how much you had to sit and wait in line to make sure you had a spot with your date.
Well, I can't answer that question definitively, Nathan, but the Radio Times recently just published a special edition official guide to Monty Python at 50 that has a number of behind-the-scenes photographs from the course of the four series, minor episode descriptions. This episode was recorded on the 7th of December, and reproduced in the front cover is a ticket from December 21st, 1969. So only a few weeks later, I'm guessing perhaps the ticket for episode 12 or episode 13. And it looks like it's gratis.
December 21st?
I did.
That is episode 10, actually.
Oh, so next week.
Next week.
It says it's a complimentary ticket and not for sale. Children under 14 are not admitted. No admittance after 7:15 p.m. And doors open at 7 o'clock and one person can get in. It's a full color ticket. Well, I suppose a three color ticket. And It's a nice little keepsake for when you leave that says that you were there for a live recording. So let's move on to our three favorite sketches of the episode.
Before we hit into that, I have to admit,
I beg your pardon.
I have to admit there are some jokes in this episode I just don't get. They may come up sort of organically as we talk about sketches. They might not, but I'll be sure to highlight them at some point. You've been primed, our dedicated audience.
But I have
two, and I will make sure to bring them up so you can school me, or we can just kind of opine about what they mean, and somebody will chime in and tell us how dumb we are because it's so obvious.
I like the idea of a kind of nighttime no laugh corner where we expose ourselves for saying, well, in every comedy, a little silence must fall.
Okay, but lead into the top three again.
However, let's first talk about the things that did work for us by talking about your three favorite sketches of the episode.
I like the llamas.
Yay!
Esta noche, presentamos con mucho gusto información interesante acerca de la llama!
Now, I admit that for me, this is a certain kind of laughter at exoticism that I do enjoy. We've enjoyed it since the first episode with the Italian lesson and the second episode with the French people. There's something about a ridiculous over-the-top European cultural stereotype that apparently appeals to me.
You know, In my mind, I was going over how many languages they have spoken and will speak over the course of the four seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And aside from Finnish, which I know comes up at some point, this might be the lot of it. You got French, Italian, and Spanish.
And German.
I know they have German characters, but are they speaking? Yeah, they are speaking German in the funniest joke in the world. So German as well. You're right.
And of course, it's important to remember that they recorded Monty Python's Fliegender Circus, where they actually had help translating, but performed their jokes in German for a German language audience, where they recreated these sketches in the first two series for Germany.
Yeah.
So there had to be a pretty good or a pretty decent command of German amongst the Pythons. I have yet to sit down and figure out who studied what language in their secondary school and college careers, whether or not they did any serious studies in university, or whether or not this is just the benefits of being Europe adjacent. We don't know at this point how Brexit will have fallen between the recording of this and the broadcast of this episode. So let's keep it on the most neutral of terms as to whether or not the UK is still in Europe.
I was thinking for this sketch, Cleese was sitting around and thinking how weird the double L sound is in Spanish.
Hmm.
And it's not just llama, which is, as every American who watched Sesame Street knows from that wonderful song, Me and My Llama Going to the Dentist Are We. It is a llama. So there's an actual second, there's a sort of a, almost a, is it a diphthong? Am I getting that right? It's an extra syllable in between the L and the ama. Llama. And I believe, this is my pet theory, that he wrote the whole sketch based upon that fact alone. Because the ridiculousness of them being out there with their overly exuberant smiles and very fake mustaches that just do not go away ever, which just makes this so enjoyable to watch.
Now, I didn't take Spanish. In fact, I am a proud member of a limited degree of Spanish language antipathy because we went to a high school with very few language options. And so there was kind of a West Side Story, Spanish versus French rivalry going on. But I am aware of the fact that in traditional Catalan Spanish, a double L is pronounced like a Y. And so I had a friend who would call me Yama, and I would call her Lloyd instead of her calling me Llama and me calling her Lloyd, just because we thought that the double L should be pronounced as a Y in these words, according to the rules of Spanish. So I can speak with zero expertise at all as to whether it should be pronounced llama, liama, or yama by a bunch of Spanish people. I also failed to look up where the llama is native to.
I think there is some South American. I seem to remember something about Aztecs with pacas. And are those related to llama? I don't...
Yeah, I think of them as Andes-related animals, but that is could be a total fabrication, a total Hollywood mishmash, or, again, as mentioned before, a complete and utter inability of mine to understand geography.
Listening audience, please remember the errata page is yours to populate with your hate mail.
But it's a very funny sketch that is fascinatingly unfunny on the page. It's not as notorious as the Nudge Nudge sketch, but there really isn't any substance to this sketch. It's a small paragraph of John Cleese talking about the animalistic characteristics of the llama incorrectly.
Tiene dos orejas, un corazón, una frente, y un pico para comer.
And then Graham Chapman rides in on a moped and pops a paper bag. I mean, there's almost nothing to this sketch. But it is performed by Jones, Idle, and Cleese with such verve and such high energy. It really is an astonishingly wonderful opening to the show. Oh, I also feel like I should point out that it's introduced as part two, The Llama. It is yet another episode of Python's Circus where they're beginning as if this is something that has been going on. I don't know how many times, but I'd say at least three prior times we have had part two or episode eight or that sort of an introduction. The show has opened with the idea that we're already in the middle of this. Catch up. You're late.
It's 90 seconds. Very short, very sweet.
Yeah.
You toss in some very simple guitar, some very bad castanets, and some really horrible mustaches, and very hideous Graham in drag, and it's delightful. Yeah, you're right. There isn't much more that really can be said.
There's no payoff. There's no button. Even for Monty Python, who's consistently uses the lack of a punchline in order to just merrily move along to the next sketch. This has a very clear ending, but no wrap-up and no culminating act in terms of a comic note to end on.
So later on in this episode, there is the refreshment room at Bletchley.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pay close attention, you'll notice it is exactly the same set. John Cleese is wearing exactly the same costume, minus the mustache, and all they've done is taken the llama off the set, and they lit it a bit differently.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm wondering if they had the live from Bletchley written first, because that is a little more intricate, with a lot more extras, and this llama thing was just tossed in last minute to fill 90 seconds of show. I mean, Eric Idle can play guitar. He's really just playing an A chord and then bringing it up two frets. And it's a very simple thing to do. He doesn't even change his position of his face. But I don't know. They merged the two sets for the same, just filming in the same physical space. No idea why.
I think that might just be good production value, where they realized they could set the stage once and use it twice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I will say, while it's an interesting theory, I like the idea conceptually that you could start the show with something that they threw together at the last minute. I feel like the essential tension of the first sketch is that you have it delivered in Spanish with subtitles on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sketch wouldn't really work at all without translation. So there's got to be some, although the audience applauds it at its conclusion, whether or not there was, they were just applauding the enthusiasm or the moped or what. They were really enjoyed it, despite the fact that they didn't have what we have, which is the projection of the subtitles in weirdly different sizes over the course of the sketch, in order for us to actually be aware of some of the ridiculous things that Cleese is saying that llamas have.
Mm-hmm.
Fins and various other anatomical abnormalities.
A beak made for eating honey, which I don't really see how that would work anyway. Also, never mind that there is a huge picture of a llama printed out photograph.
That's right.
Which they probably commissioned the same people who printed out the Irving C. Salisbury Jr. photo from a couple episodes previous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same production shop.
Yeah. this also it appears in one or two of their live shows, if I recall correctly.
Interesting.
I only know that it's not in the Hollywood Bowl. It's not in... actually, I think it might be live at City Center.
Okay.
because I've only heard it before, and that is, I only have an audio recording of that. I think that's the only medium in which it exists to this day.
So you actually have experienced it without translation and without the knowledge.
Actually, what happens in the audio recording is it's the same John Cleese, like, Buenas noches, señoras y señores. But they have Michael Palin reading over everything that you would normally read on the show. So Michael Palin is saying, the llama is a quadruped. So you do experience the audio, but it's actually just overdubbed by Palin.
Okay. All right. What comes in for number two sketch for you?
Number two sketch. This has a number of different names, but I'm going to call it the George Head sketch.
And now for something completely different. The office of Sir George Head. O-B-E.
Also known as the Kilimanjaro or mountaineering sketch.
So we alluded to this earlier when we were talking about the echoing John Cleese over the titles, where John Cleese plays Sir George Head, a mountain climber who seems to have the strange binocular ability to see everything as twos.
One at a time, please. There is only me, sir. So there is.
Where he believes two people have entered into his office to participate in their mountain climbing expedition. He believes that there are two peaks of Kilimanjaro. And when he looks up the definition of mountaineer in the dictionary, he reads off that it is defined as
two men skilled in climbing mountains.
Not to mention the fact that when he is trying to describe the route to get to Kilimanjaro, every town is doubled. You go from Purley's to Purbright's and Rocking Deans, which is a coastal town south on the south of England. I had to look up. Then you get to Nairobi's.
Everything is plural.
Everything is duplicated.
What about this sketch particularly appealed to you?
I see this sketch as a open jab at the upper class. And I like how dim they make George Head. It's kind of smug and unshakable. Like, everything he says is wrong or very misleading. But he doesn't. That doesn't seem to bother him at all. And the Eric Idle character, the straight character, keeps on saying, it's like, well, there is only me. Why can't you see that what you're doing is ridiculous?
Well, I'm afraid I shan't be coming on your expedition, sir, as I've absolutely no confidence in anyone involved in it.
Oh, dear.
But Cleese just doesn't have a word of it. He doesn't pay attention to that at all. And so I like the openness of it, how they're kind of taking a stab at kind of the upper crust, stiff upper lip portion of British society. That's how I would interpret it.
I think there's a lot of meat in that. In the complete, thoroughly unillustrated, absolutely unauthorized guide to possibly all the references by Daryl Larson, he talks about the fact that it takes a certain kind of upper crust person to refer to a woman in his life as a matron. And of course, we do have the punchline in there where he says, you know, of course, matron will be coming with you. And Eric Idle's character sort of rolls his eyes and goes,
apart from the two matrons.
Good God, I forgot about her.
Whereas he sort of looks down his nose at the idea that, of course, you're going to have a servant woman going along with you while you climb Kilimanjaro. I should have expected that. But he doesn't consider that to be part of the crew that would be actually necessary in order to scale and summit a mountain. That's just sort of his disappointed reaction to this is what a kind of person that Head would need in order to make his ascent.
Okay, so this might be a good time to say that I do not get that joke. I didn't get it first time I heard it on the And Now for Something Completely Different. The joke, which is apart from the two matrons. And then Head says, good God, I forgot about her, which gets a big laugh. I don't really understand that. So that may have been one step towards explaining it to me.
I think the other step towards explaining it to you is that it's the only thing he doesn't double is that he says,
well, matron's got a smattering.
And then Idle says, apart from the two matrons. And he goes, oh, right. There are two of them. The only person the only thing in the whole world that he has put down as one. And so it's a strange inversion of his doubling that in this case, he's forgotten one half of his doubling as he was taking account of the things that will be coming with him.
It gets a laugh from the audience, but it also kind of washes up what was just said about...
Does anyone speak Swahili, sir?
Oh, yes, I think most of them do, Dando.
It is a marvelously blithe upper-class line. It's a great punchline, but it also helps reinforce your point as to the advantageous cluelessness of the upper class that is incipient to, implicit to... George Head.
This also has somewhere in my top 10 Monty Python lines that I like to just mutter at times in my life. Kilimanjaro is a pretty tricky climb. Most of it's up to the very, very top and then tends to slip away rather sharply. Has just stuck with me for a good most of my adult life.
How do you feel about Graham Chapman's appearance in the sketch?
Jimmy Blenkinsop, Arthur Wilson, Jimmy Blenkinsop. Hello. Arthur Wilson 2, Jimmy Blenkinsop 1, Jimmy Blenkinsop Wilson, Arthur Wilson 2. Carry on, Jimmy.
I like him better in the And Now for Something Completely Different.
Okay.
Only because when he marches around the office here, he just seems like he's making mayhem for mayhem's sake without doing any real climbing. He's just kind of pulling things off of desks and off of walls.
When, after the chapter, we'll find that one of them has a problem, and of course, we have
some
rather difficult
climate. It's still funny, but it doesn't land as funny as it does in the movie.
So in the recreated version, it gives you more of an impression that he's actually attempting to climb the office, and he blurs the line between what the climbing of Kilimanjaro and the climbing of the furniture in the office would be like.
A little bit, yeah. He also has the gag of plowing his head through the door, which they do not do in the show. The door remains open, so if it was a gag they meant to do, they did not do it because no one shut the door when Graham walked in. What do you have to say about it?
I mean, I think you've covered most of the points. The only thing I would bring up is the interesting twist of the magical realism of the ending. That up until this point, we've been convinced by Eric Idle's straight man that this is just lunacy. In fact, even so far as the way in which Cleese has the repeated behavior of being able to cover one of his eyes, and then he can suddenly realize that there's only one person or only one thing in the room. When he looks closely at the map, and when he's confused by Graham Chapman climbing around the office, he also puts one hand up to his eye so as to better understand what's going on. He is instinctively aware of the fact that there is a behavior that will help clear up any confusion that he might have. He has a trick for working around it. But then at the end, when Idle's character says, "I have no faith in this expedition or anybody who's partaking in it," and storms out of the office, Cleese then turns to the illusory second idol that he's believed has been there the whole time and says,
"Well, how about you?"
"Well, I'm game, sir." "So are we."
And magically, there is a second idol there. And then it cuts back to George Head, and there are two of them. So it's a strange fairyland ending to the sketch that actually confirms that for all his idiocy, he was actually right the whole time. And I find that to be a clever escalation. The sketch already has really good escalation in terms of introducing the concept and then going weirder and weirder with it. I believe that the map that Cleese refers to is actually a map of England that just happens to be pulled down over a map of Africa. And so when he's tracing the route, he's going through the boroughs around London and then reaches the bottom of the map and continues into Nairobi because he doesn't understand that there are two separate maps. There are weird little bits of increasing understanding of just how screwed up he is. And then, of course, when Chapman's character comes in, it feels like he's going to be the sane center of this when he says,
"Don't worry about the, we'll get him up somehow."
And then, of course, he ends up being just as crazy. So he's not an oasis of sanity in the middle. He's his own particular brand of weirdness. I think in terms of what you would do in an improv sketch where you want to keep on upping the ante in order to get to it to be funnier and funnier, it's a very well-constructed sketch in that way. So that the ending is particularly surprising.
I'm of the mind it's not exactly necessary to have that reveal that it really is how George Head perceives the world as actually the reality, that there are two of everything. But it's since it's a comedy joke part, it could be either, really. I think for the And Now for Something Completely Different, they do not have George Head with himself on a green screen being spliced in. But they do have the second Eric Idle, Arthur Jackson. But to me, the humor comes from just seeing how crazy it gets with everything being doubled. And I enjoy watching Eric Idle getting more and more upset by that. He plays a very good, nervous character.
Hmm.
He's very fun to watch because he is pretty short and he has shaggy hair. And he looks very cute and innocent. I think he plays that very well. So having him be the person who's watching what could be the person who leads him to his demise, essentially admit to him that we have no skill on this death-defying trip. And oh, by the way, nobody speaks the language and you're the only one of us who could take us up there, so will you join? I find that delightful.
Not to mention the fact that the first trip is lost because they tried to climb up a peak of a mountain that wasn't actually there. Aside from the does anyone speak Swahili joke, I think that might be my favorite part of the sketch.
Now, the object of this expedition is to see if we can find any traces of last year's expedition.
Another double. Another secret double in the sketch. This is exposition number two.
I do also like the...
Well, bang goes his application then.
I find myself saying that a lot. Bang goes that idea. That comes from that sketch.
Talk to me about sketch number three.
So number three I had some difficulty with because the one I decided on, I like it, but there are going to be lots of problems with it.
All right.
And that is The Visitors.
Ah ha ha. Good. Let's contextualize and describe this sketch a little bit. It begins with Graham Chapman and Carol Cleveland in a dimly lit room with some soft music playing in the background.
Would you mind terribly if I held your hand?
Oh no, not at all.
And they're escalating their romance to the part of potentially holding hands, about as innocent as you can get. At which point, somebody comes in the door, and then it is a series of interruptions of terrible, crass people more and more and more over the course of the remainder of the sketch, of the last sort of people you'd want to come in when this kind of chaste romance is your ideal evening. And we have...
I'm Arthur, Arthur name by name, but not by nature.
I always say that, then I'm Vicky Boy.
As played by Eric Idle, and then we have...
My name is Equator, Brian Equator, light round the middle of the earth, only with an L.
Played by John Cleese and Terry Jones. Then Terry Gilliam comes in full Queen Pride Parade getup as Mr. Freight. And he has just met and found this lovely little man, which is Michael Palin playing an early version of Ken Shabby under a different name with a goat. And then the Tomlinson Singers come in as a load of Welsh miners to have a ding-dong around the piano.
Is Eric Idle's character the same as the Nudge Nudge character?
His costume is virtually identical. I will point out briefly that he introduces himself with the line,
"Remember me?
Oh, no.
In the pub, the tall, thin one with a moustache. Remember?"
So he doesn't think he's quite as short as you described him earlier in the mountaineering sketch. But yes, next to Graham Chapman and John Cleese, he doesn't necessarily come across as particularly elevated.
Though he does say about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Would not be coincident with the timing of the show, but is funny in the sense that you don't remember my name, but it was 3 years ago. Don't you remember that? And oh how I've grown since that time. I've had all kinds of one-night stands.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, don't worry about me, Vicky Boy. I know all about one-night stands.
Whereas the gentleman in Wink Wink Nudge Nudge was faking it. So either Arthur Name is similarly faking it for the purposes of trying to ingratiate himself into this house in order to get a drink and interrupt what's going on, or he has in fact escalated quite quickly after receiving a lesson about the birds and the bees from Terry Jones. There are a couple of things I'd like to mention about this sketch. The first of which is not particularly controversial, is that according to Daryl Larson, the song that's playing on the record player is a song from Dudley Moore. It's a song performed by Dudley Moore that's actually on the Beyond the Fringe album. And so for Eric Idle to come in and remove it is an interesting little dig at the fact that the pythons were currently in the process of supplanting the Dudley Moore generation in terms of the satire boom movement giving way to the absurdist movement that was being done by the Python Boys and by Q. Is that what the Spike Milligan show is called? I think it might be called
Q5.
Yes. And so that the comedy is sort of coming in and rudely interrupting the national tone of what's going on and saying, nope, we're here now.
And violently tossing it away like a frisbee.
Right.
Is the song that he puts on, is that a John Philip Sousa march?
It is, I believe.
Bam, ba-da, 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 ba-da. We don't have to have me sing in this.
I believe it's called the Washington Square March. It's the Washington something march, and it is a Sousa. According to Larson, it's performed by the exact same orchestra that performs the Liberty Bell that they use specifically in the introduction. So it must have been something that the Beeb had licensing rights to.
To your point, another removing the older with the, stand-in for a Monty Python musical reference.
Right. If you have started to associate Sousa with Python, then it is therefore symbolic that Python would be put on the record player and it would be loud and brash and in your face. So this sketch is listed in Entertainment Weekly's 2005 article of the 20 funniest sketches that Monty Python had ever done. This includes sketches that are in the feature films, and The Visitors comes in at number 16 out of 20. So if you think of all of the sketches in the three feature films, in the 40-some-odd episodes, this sketch is in the top 20, according to Entertainment Weekly. What I found interesting, most interesting, was I feel like there are two essential ways in which you can interpret this. Is this a commentary on the prudishness of the middle class? That they are unhappy with the fact that, you know, all these terrible lower class deviant people are busting in, miners and workers and slobs and gays, and then they shoot him and take over his apartment? Is it about the slippery slope of Britain is transforming into these terrible people? Or is it just, you know, escalation? It really comes down to how do you feel about Brian Equator sort of as the centerpiece, as to whether or not we are supposed to find these people loathsome or agreeable. Because with particular reference to Terry Gilliam as Mr. Freight, the character is introduced as...
Oh, I took the liberty of inviting an old friend along. His wife has just passed away and he's somewhat distraught, poor chap. Oh, you don't mind.
At which point he prances in these thigh-high white boots and a glittery cape and a mask and a cigarette at the end of a cigarette holder.
And a thong.
Yes. And he says, I've just found this lovely little man. And Cleese's character says, is he sexy? He just totally is accepting of the fact that this man is going through this transition and doesn't judge him for it at all. From a modern perspective, that's an incredibly valuable thing to do. That he's just like, you know, he's quite crass. He's quite terrible towards Carol Cleveland in the way he treats her as a sex object. And yet, this astonishingly pride parade portrayal by Terry Gilliam, he just takes in stride and accepts. It's hard to find that terrible and loathsome. It's, in fact, easy to find it as kind of nice and refreshing that a man this terrible would be that accepting of his friend because he's either going through something or this is who he is now. And at the other hand, he calls him a poof. It's the second use of the word in the series, previously used during the Avine Aviation French skit, where we have Sir Brian Zapatatique referred to as Le Pouf Célèbre. I have a little bit on Pouf from the OED. It first appears, according to them, in 1833 and is generally considered to be a phrase that is derisive and not complimentary. But there's a quote that's used as a contextual reference by Graham Greene in The Quiet American from 1955, which goes, he made a feeble attempt to mock my accent. You all talk like poofs. You're so damned superior. And I think it's interesting that that context is that it is linking upper class and a refined sensibility with homosexuality and from the time effeminacy as a negative. And so there, it's interesting to point out that here, Brian Equator, perfectly okay with this kind of display.
So are you saying that the Brian Equator character is kind of normalizing homosexuality?
It depends on what you think the character represents. If he represents the decline of Britain, then his acceptance of this behavior is part of his sin and part of how terrible he is.
Hmm.
If you think that actually, secretly, Victor is the problem, that he and his weird, decorous, childlike romance is actually the thing that's awful, and that these people should bust in and liven him up a little bit, and he's too repressed to actually join in the fun, then actually he's a good person, despite the fact that he's crass and awful, that he has his heart in the right place, and that we should side with him, and he should shoot Graham Chapman's character and take over his house.
Hmm.
I don't think there are any clear indications in the sketch as to which way you should fall. I don't know, but I find it an interesting knife's edge, particularly when the major centerpiece of this episode is the Lumberjack song, which is also about issues of femininity and masculinity, is centered around the idea that this person didn't want to be a barber, didn't want to touch men's heads, but actually wanted to be a lumberjack, this mighty, brutal, amazing, masculine trait, which he then undermines by wanting to dress up in women's clothing and press flowers into books and preserve their daintiness for all time. It's presented as a joke. It's presented as loathsome because the Mounties are so disgusted they can't even finish the song, which, of course, changes in the live performances where they all rush back together and sing the chorus at the very end.
For me, it's a difficult line to tread because this does fall into my top three. I didn't think about it quite so philosophically as you have. Mm. For me, I do like how raunchy it is. Essentially, that's pretty much all I have to say. They have amped up just how terrible night this guy Victor is having, culminating in his own demise. That is just enjoyable for me to watch. Now, I should say, so I did say at the top, there were a couple of jokes in this episode I don't get.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I still don't get, even now that I've seen this script, is when he says, "It's my name is Brian Equator, like around the middle of the earth, but only with an L." I looked up the script thinking it would be Equator, ending E-Q-U-A-T-O-L, but it is not. It's actually Equator. So I'm not quite sure I am bright enough to understand the humor in this decrepit sketch.
I found a comment on the Onion AV Club where a user said that both in the script and in the subtitles, it's listed as Equator. But I similarly went to the script and it very much doesn't. You are correct in that. I do wonder as to whether or not the people who put together the subtitles for the DVDs were also so confused by that punchline that they changed it to Equator in the subtitles in order to help make sense of it. I think it doesn't work. I think it's just a piece of randomness. I don't believe he pronounces it Equator. I have been similarly flummoxed by it, and I think that there was an effort out there to try and fix it that some people have believed was intentional, but I don't.
I'm wondering if it is a dialectual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the working class doesn't pronounce their R's in a way which is more like received pronunciation.
Mm-hmm.
And it does come out Equator, which is an OL kind of like sounding of those at the end of that word versus the more erudite Equator, which may be more like an OR spelling. I don't know. Complete guess.
The L and the R are what are, I believe, referred to as liquid consonants. And that's one of the reasons why the traditional Asian stereotype has those letters being switched in pronunciation.
Hmm.
Because they are actually sounds that can be substituted one for the other.
I do want to point out that I think the best part of this sketch is Carol Cleveland.
Hmm.
I think she gives a fantastic performance, and the comic timing she has and the expressiveness of her face and the great subtle eye rolls, to me, that's what I really like to watch, is her performance. And I only bring that up because the first time they shot this sketch, which is actually a week before the one that you're seeing on the episode, according to the Pythons autobiography by the Pythons, Terry Jones talks about how they actually filmed that scene with Mrs. Equator, played by an actual actress.
Hmm.
But the quote is, "But there was something strange about the kind of comedy we did. It was difficult for a woman to do, like in the Mr. Equator sketch, where we had Mr. and Mrs. Equator. We shot it with a very wonderful, funny lady actress, and we didn't think it worked. So he cut it out of that show and redid it the next week with Terry Jones playing Mrs. Equator."
Hmm. That is fascinating.
So you're removing all females from the scene except for Carol Cleveland.
Hmm.
And her timing is perfect. I just want to give a little shout out to her.
That's great. I like that. I also think it's key that in the past we've talked about how some of your preferred sketches are ones where the entire cast is on screen.
Oh, true.
Because it gives a sense of collaboration.
This is true.
I listened to a podcast this week that talked about in the opinion of the person that was talking, some of the best shows on television are shows where they have read-throughs of the scripts, where they have table reads before they actually perform, because it creates a sense of community. And if I don't have any evidence of this, but it did remind me that I had read in the past that the Pythons would get together and read their sketches as they were working on them to each other, that they would have room read-throughs of whatever was in progress, and they'd perform them for each other. I really do feel like some of the collaborative energy of the troupe and some of the success of the troupe is mirrored in what this actor said, is that the best television shows are the ones where everybody participates, and that there is an ineffable energy to having all six of them, and seven, including Carol, on set at the same time, working together in materials that they've all read and listened to and are anticipating performing together.
Agreed.
Well, with that consensus, let's move on to the Monty Python Minute. Nathan, I have gone to random.org, and I have plugged in the length of the episode, and I have hit generate. And it has given me a number of a sketch that we have not talked about. So we will have a little bit of a moment with it, and we'll see what you think. And then I have some trivia for you.
Okay.
Today's Monty Python Minute is Minute 21. And now the mystery voice for listeners at home. Minute 21.
Okay, 30 seconds, is that right?
Yes, you have 30 seconds to describe the minute that you've just viewed, and then I have a series of trivia questions that you have a minute and a half to answer in order to try and achieve 21 points equal to the number.
All right.
Sounds impossible, and yes it is. So, your 30 seconds begin now.
This is a filmed portion called The Hunting Film, where we have a bunch of clips of the Monty Python members doing various hunting things up in probably Scotland or something. They start off by batting out some couples who are obviously making out in some brush. They shoot themselves into the earth. They shoot down a pilot from the sky. They also
discover
a shotgun, and they shoot a bird, which tucks the guy in the face with an egg, and they come home. Only with a tiny little bird to show for their efforts, and one of them is dead. That's Michael Palin.
Very briefly, before we move on to the trivia section, I do want to say, in reading the script for this episode, the fact that one of them is dead isn't in the script. I think that's something they worked out on the day. The idea that because they're all walking out with so many guns ablazing that they accidentally shoot one of themselves and leave his body behind. I believe that was unplanned. At least it's not mentioned as a detail in the script. So I think they probably figured it out as a joke on set as they were doing it. All right, Nathan.
Yes.
Nathan, you have a choice.
Oh, gosh.
We referred earlier to the fact that while this episode is called The Ant and Introduction, there are no ant content in the episode. However, episode 41, is pretty much all about ants. So you can either answer a series of questions about other silent films that have been in the series so far that we've talked about in the previous 8 episodes, or you can answer a series of questions about the department store buying an ant sketch.
I would like to have this be an inclusive experience. So all the people, all 3 of you who are still listening, to be able to relish in the other podcasts that we've talked about, and we've talked about quite heavily the silent filmed portions.
Okay.
So let's talk about previous episode silent film bits.
There are 8 previous silent film style segments that have been performed in the previous 8 episodes. Mm. And your challenge is to name 7 of them in order to achieve 21 points. I will give you the episode number and you can try and remember.
Okay.
What?
I can't look at my skit listing.
I mean, you can try. But you've only got a minute and a half, so
okay.
You want to flip through your previous notes and use your time that way. I can give you hints.
Okay, that might be helpful.
All right.
Well, I know one of them. Is the time to start
all
yet?
All right, ready, go.
Undressing in public.
That's episode 4.
How many of them are there?
There's another one. Gosh. There's another one in episode 4 that involves bathing.
The Royals on the Beach.
Correct. The sedan chair bathing. In episode 5, there's an extended silent segment that uses silent film techniques.
Episode 5, hey?
They come out of a van, they construct a stage.
Oh, the Confused Cat.
In episode 3, there's a very short silence film that involves a seduction of a...
Sorry, Milkman.
Correct. In episode 2, we have narration over a classic silent film involving royalty.
The Wacky Queen.
Correct. In episode 6, we have an extended series of strange events that happen to a normal person.
The Strange Life of a City Stockbroker.
In episode 7,
City Stockbroker.
We have a series of... Oh, I'm sorry. And that is a minute and 30. In episode 7, we have silent film techniques used for the No One's Left in England because everyone has moved to Scotland. So we have a montage of scenes. And in episode 8, we have a flasher exposing himself to a bunch of women, except it turns out he's just wearing a sign around his neck that says boo.
I'm sorry, everybody.
No.
I am sorry.
You did exceptionally well. We got 6 out of 7, which is not quite 7 out of 8, but... It's near as damn it. I feel like if I had taken slightly less time in describing them, we would have gotten there. Nicely done.
Thank you. Now we're moving on to the part of the show where we talk about our top 5 moments. These are our top 5 favorite moments, which are short little bits of cartoon, film, or a sketch, which just make us smile. Could just be a word that someone says, could be a laugh they give, could just be a look. Benjamin, up and yummy. Do you have a top 5 moment for me?
I do. I love the moment where the psychotic barber wheels out the tape recorder in order to create the illusion of cutting Terry Jones's hair.
Can I stop cutting your hair, sir? Start cutting now.
Nice day, sir.
Yeah, sir. Flowers could do with a drop of rain there.
Ah, yes.
Particularly the little bit where he's recorded a line of dialogue while he's using a pair of clippers and is aware of the fact that Terry Jones's character won't be able to hear him, and so then he has to repeat it loudly in response to the question of,
yeah, good game, I thought.
I thought Hurst played well, sir.
Big pardon?
I thought Hurst played well.
Oh, yes, anyone who did that.
Can you put your head down a little?
I'm sorry? That level of pre-programming is totally unrealistic, and yet It raises a chuckle from the audience, and it's definitely one of my favorite parts of the episode.
That's awesome. That's actually one of my top favorites, too.
Ha ha! Stolen.
Number two, the refreshment room at Bletchley.
Interesting.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the refreshment room here at Bletchley. My name is Kenny Lush, and I'm your compere for tonight.
There is a time in our past, you and I, Ben, where we traveled to a different city in these great United States. I think it was Pittsburgh, where we went to go see Eric Idle sings Crossed Out Steel's Monty Python. And the show starts with Eric Idle coming on stage and giving this most obsequious, drool-worthy introduction to Monty Python that is exactly the same as the very greasy compere as he comes out with Bletchley. To introduce Harry Fink.
Ladies and gentlemen, the incomparably superior human being, Harry Fink!
But only in the Pittsburgh show, it was Monty Python, followed by the pathetic line,
"He can't come!"
Oh, he's not as cracked up to be. So that little bit of driveling, I like that. I find that funny.
This tour is recounted by Idle in his Greedy Bastard Tour memoir. And the Monty Python, Eric Idle rips off Monty Python tour. That was a great trip. And it was, I believe, our first occasion of seeing one of the Pythons live. It was a gift we gave ourselves to begin this long tradition of hunting them all down.
First of three, if I recall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will follow that up by saying, for my number three moment, the thing that I genuinely enjoy, at the beginning of the hunting sketch, the transition into it is a follow-up from the barber. After having been ridiculed by the Tomlinson singers, we have the customer and Michael Palin sitting dejectedly, and Palin says,
"Yes, pity really. I always preferred the outdoor life. Hunting, shooting, fishing. Getting out there with a gun, slaughtering a few of God's creatures."
And I've always enjoyed that line. It's definitely the kind of spirit that Python uses a lot. I think you can find that same tone in the hymn, All Things... What's the name of the song? All Things Cruel and Merciless.
Oh, yeah, All Things Cruel and Ugly.
Yeah, All Things... Yes, thank you. Is legitimately one of my favorite ever Python moments in their entire oeuvre. That hymn continues to inspire me on a regular basis, particularly when I think of how nasty wasps are every year when they build their nests outside my home and office windows. And I think about the way that they reproduce by laying their eggs in other creatures so that their offspring chew their way out. That is such an appalling, disgusting thing that God has given us. So I'm also therefore in favor of going outside and killing a few of God's creatures. And I like it phrased in that precise way.
Number four, the knight is not needed this week.
"I'm sorry, we don't need you this week."
Oh, you've stolen my last one.
Now I am not a huge fan of the knight appearing and smacking people upside the head with what looks like a very real dead chicken. But I have noticed that gag evolves over the course of the series, mm-hmm. to the point where in episode 7, You're No Fun Anymore, it actually got a top 5 moment for me, just how quickly the knight appeared on the scene to thwack John Cleese on the head. In the previous two showings, the knight is a little more slow in his approach to the point of being not funny to me. But I like how in this episode, episode 9, the casting director, or the guy behind the producer who's behind the camera, tells whoever is in the costume, presumably Terry Gilliam, just as the guy in the suit of armor, as he's like warming up his chicken, I'm gonna hit this guy. No. We don't need you this week. Like, the gag has been cut. And he sluggishly walks off the set into a bit of film,
mm-hmm.
and then walks by John Cleese as he turns and says, "And now for something completely different." I find that funny.
One of two "now for something completely different" in the episode. There's a lengthy piece of film in the very beginning of the episode where we pan around Ada's snack bar and cafe in order to find John Cleese at a desk.
Mm-hmm.
Very lengthy. You talked earlier about perhaps the episode needed a little bit of filling out. out. That is quite a long stretch of film of just the side of a building before we get to Cleese delivering us a link. Mm-hmm. But I do enjoy that particular tone. Similarly with the knight walking past the chicken coop. Mm. It's not inherently necessary to the humor. It's just a piece of shoe leather. But to me, it makes the absurdity of finding the link producer in these strange settings that much more enjoyable. And which, of course, is why it becomes a regular feature as the opening for series two.
So I'm going to swoop in and put down my flag for number five.
Hit me.
Which is actually the not two, but three appearances of John Cleese as the end now for something completely different.
Oh.
Linking announcer.
Which one did I forget?
You forgot the one where he appears in a split screen.
And now for something completely different. A man with a tape recorder up his brother's nose.
Yes.
Where he's talking on the phone, puts the phone down in what... It's actually quite curious because in one, the left-hand side, they clearly have the camera just slightly to John's left, so he had to tilt to his left, looking more center to the screen. And the right half of the screen, he does the opposite. So it looks like they're on two physical separate sides of a stage looking towards you. And he says, and now for something completely different, in a slightly stereoed way. But I would put number five as the three appearances of John Cleese.
Nicely done. It's interesting that it's the technical aspect of that appeals to you so much. The cleverness of the production and the staging is what makes that stand out to you. That's a good observation.
They must have had 1,000 different ideas to make things slightly different or nuanced or just new and fresh. Some of them were probably too hard to do, but others were just, okay, we can just splice this together. This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, performed, edited, and laughed at by the two of us, Ben Russell and Nathan Emley. Sound design by him and by me.
Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and sourced from Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, dates, facts, ants, data of any kind that you feel is incorrect or missing. Please contact us via the website and we'll post it on our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as humanly possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
Olé!
We'll see you next time when we discussed episode 10, Untitled. So what the hell is the deal with inflatable knees anyway?
Oh, man. I don't...
Ken Buddha and Billy Islam, is that what he says?
Yeah, two bangs in a religion. You sure we don't want to cut this into the episode?
I think it'll just take us out on that.
All right, I like it.